Some find them cute, some find them repulsive, and science finds them useful. Mice have been a model organism for a bit over a century and is by far the most used nowadays. Let's find out what these little creatures did for scientific discoveries and learn cool facts about them at the same time. Hello, curious cats, and welcome to Choosing Science mini-series about model organisms. If you like what I'm doing here, check out my main series about scientists that discovered really impressive stuff and had really inspirational lives, but they're less known. They're not maybe the Einsteins or Newtons, but they deserve just as much recognition as them. So if you want to know more, listen to that one. And let's get going to our little friends that I've been talking today, mice. First, let's understand what the model organism is actually. Maybe you've been hearing this term, or maybe you're vaguely familiar with it, but it's good to have our facts straight from the beginning. This term is used to describe non-human species in which scientists can model and research different biological processes and phenomena. It can be from anatomical and medical studies down to molecular mechanisms and anything in between. These species are usually easy to maintain, and their genetics and characteristics can be manipulated. They may also be studied to further understand evolution, especially when they represent pivotal points in the evolutionary tree. All in all, they were the key for many revolutionary discoveries, which led to tremendous improvement in life expectancy and quality for the human species. It's also kind of the more ethical alternative to very unethical stuff like human subject testing. So, while I'm not necessarily happy that animals are usually used for this kind of experiments and discoveries, I do understand the importance and the necessity to have them. And with this mini-series, I want to kind of put them at the forefront and cherish their importance and the sacrifices they did for our benefit in the end. So the mouse is also the most popular among the wider public. Everybody probably has heard or seen all cool or crazy experiments that have been done with their help. But have you ever wondered why all the pictures with lab mice portray mostly white mice, or why they were chosen as a primary animal model in the first place? Well, the lab mouse, or Mus musculus in its Latin name, has been studied since the 17th century, when William Harvey used them to study reproduction and circulation. What makes them great as a model is the fact that they have a high reproductive rate. So gestation period is just 10 weeks, which is very short. In comparison to ours, that is never ending, or other animals that have years of gestation, which is crazy. They also have a short lifespan. Every year is equivalent to 30 human years, which arguably it's not necessarily good for them, but it's good for the scientist because they don't have to wait 30 years for them to reach maturity or something like that, because then nothing will be done ever. And they are from the same clade as humans, meaning that we do share many of the functional genes and biological processes. They're mammals just like us. Many inbred strains have been created which have as little genetic variance as possible. And that is important because when you compare results and data, you want to have as little variance and variability as possible so you can actually accurately compare them and draw some useful conclusions. There are characteristics that differ among the strains. So depending on the goals of the experiment or trial, there needs to be done. It needs to be a careful selection before the start of the experiment. Some strains are more prone to some disorders or diseases because they're inbred, right? Or display different behavior patterns. So if you're conducting some sociological, psychological, whatever study, you really need to know if one strain is happier or more depressed than others, so you know with what bias you're starting that research. And these strains have been created at the beginning of the 20th century by Abby Lethrop, Clarence Cook Little, and Nest Castle. But why are they, or most of the strains, white? The prevalence of albinism among lab rodents is because many of the earliest established strains were albino. And also, albinism is an easy selection marker in the early days. So before, when they didn't know about genes, genome, genetics in general that much, they would have a visible marker to discriminate against different individuals. The lack of pigment is due to a mutation in an enzyme which results in decreased amount of melanin, like in our case as well in other mammals. The whole genome sequencing of the mouse was finished in 2002 with 3,500 million base pairs and 20 pairs of chromosomes. Although their genome is around 10% smaller than ours, have 3,000 more protein coding genes, which does make research a bit complicated, but at least we know where they're coming from. So, what are they actually used for more concretely? I'm gonna give you some examples. One that I really like is genetic conditions. So the coolest part about this model is that you can design genetic tools to switch genes on and off, knock them out completely, or put them into overdrive, as well as inducing mutant versions for the gene of interest. You can even select the time and cell or tissue when this is happening. So it doesn't necessarily have to be organism that you can target. Maybe you're interested in liver, let's say. You can actually target the liver cell specifically and see what happens. Or if you are studying a congenital mutation, you can design a mouse that carries it. And in this manner, you can observe its effect on the development of the mouse and its later life. Numerous genes have been tested this way to determine how they influence lifespan, life quality, the proclivity to different diseases like heart issues, neurodegenerative issues, obesity, diabetes, and so on. As you might know, in our case as well, some congenital issues do come with specific types of comorbidities. Some of them come with maybe a higher chance of getting a heart attack, getting dementia, or suffering from diabetes and obesity, and so on. But what is even cooler is the ability to study polygenic disorders in mice. Polygenic meaning more than one gene is involved in this disorder, which makes them very complex and hard to study. Such examples are schizophrenia or autism spectrum disorder. Given their complexity, it can be extremely difficult to determine how many genes play a role, how they may or may not interact, or to what degree, and this all is made possible through mice studies. There are many ways to design these mice, but recently the one that seems to get more and more traction is the CRISPR-Cas9, which has opened a whole new world of possibilities for researchers. Most likely you already heard of it. It's getting more and more popular, and a few years ago scientists got the Nobel Prize for it. That is because you can introduce virtually any genetic background, meaning that you don't have to rely so heavily on crossbreeding between different mouse strains or changing the genetics through more complex and time-consuming methods. An example is the strain that suffers from spontaneous type 1 diabetes, which through CRISPR in a key gene that has been strongly correlated with diabetes in people. The resulting mice showed increased autoimmune diabetes, this underlying the connection of inherited characteristics and environmental factors when it comes to diabetes, and pointed towards exploring this. So narrowing the pool of possibilities is crucial in research, and this example illustrated perfectly. Another scenario where mice were very useful is when it comes to understanding molecular mechanisms in health, prevention, and disease. Now, there are different ways in which one can study molecular mechanisms in mice through gene expression control. There are some really cool systems out there that use different triggers, such as light or specific drugs. You can also choose a tissue or specific cell type, as well as the time when the gene should be expressed or knocked out. Knocked out meaning that it's not expressed anymore, it's completely gone. In this manner, many functions of the cell, tissues, and even whole bodies can be studied. I'll give you an example that involves optogenetics, which basically just means using light as a trigger of this turning on and off of the genes. So there are mice lines that have been engineered to have a specific cell sensitivity to light, which will turn off and on genes when subjected to a beam of light. It can also be designed to have different responses to different kinds of light, so blue, red, whatever you need, making it even more versatile. In 2021, a student at Northwestern University, Mingzheng Wu, implanted blue light LEDs in the prefrontal cortex of two mice, which had neurons sensitive to light in a specific part of the brain that is tightly correlated to social behavior. Then he put them together in a box, and at first the mice were reluctant to interact with each other. He then switched on the blue light in the wireless implants and fired up the target neurons. And in a matter of minutes, the mice started to interact with each other like they've been friends forever. There is also a video of the experiment. I'll link it in the description. It was pretty impressive. I really, really liked it. Maybe it's a bit barbaric to implant LEDs into their brains, but they made friends, right? There's a silver lining. Another more well-established scientific area where mice have been used over and over and over again is drug development. So let's move on to the less pleasant. Maybe it's less pleasant and also, in my opinion, not that cool, but it's also very important. So part of the drug and substance discovery, validation and approval is testing on mice. So it takes a very long time to get a drug from its inception, discovery, let's say, of the compound, to actually being used on the market. And in this process, at this moment, it is necessary to have a phase where it's extensively tested on mice. So while it makes sense to a certain degree, it's getting more and more evident that there is a dire need to transition to better fitted testing models, because there isn't a certain agreed upon number of false positives, for example. But one figure I found released by the German Medicine Authority said that between 25 to 36% of all the tested substances came out as false positive, which is extremely high, meaning that almost a quarter, even more to a third, they came out to be doing something when in reality they weren't, or even more, even worse than that, they were doing harm in humans. I found a publication written by Hartung et al. written in 2008, and it says, I quote, "The question might, however, be raised whether mutagenicity in human cells should be ruled out at all by an animal test. A genotoxic effect in vitro shows that the substance has a property which could be hazardous. Differences in the in vivo test can be either species-specific, rat versus human, or due to kinetics, meaning does not reach the tissue at sufficiently high concentrations. These do not necessarily rule out a hazard towards humans, especially in chronic situations or hypersensitivity of individuals. This means that the animal experiment may possibly hide the hazard for humans." Or, I mean, false positives, it's one thing. Worst case scenario, in the end it doesn't do anything. It's just a waste of money and time, which is not trivial, but still. Even worse, though, are the false negatives, meaning that it might look like it does something beneficial, and then after this phase, you go on and test it on people, and it's disastrous. I'll give you one famous case in UK, in which a new antibody therapy passed the animal trials. And all six human subjects that received 500 times smaller dose than the mice actually got faced life-threatening side effects. That is not to say that all animal testing is useless, but that there needs to be more awareness, and not only to spare animals from unnecessary tests, but also demand better human-specific tests that need to be developed. And hopefully more resources will be allocated for finding them in the future. And the good news is that it is already happening. New genotoxicity tests are arising based on human-derived, mouse-derived cells that can be collected without killing the animal. So basically, there are tests in a dish. One of those is the micronuclei test. I found it very interesting. It consists of subjecting bone marrow or peripheral blood to the tested compounds and analyzing the cell's nucleus after a certain amount of time to check for damage. It is an extremely successful assay that has been approved by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. That was a mouthful. So what it means is that you grow cells in a dish, you add your compound that you want to test, and if you see any damage to the integrity of the cell, it most likely means that if you put it in a living being, it might not end well. So it takes that out of the trial. A lot of time and resources and life spared. So this was just a brief introduction of how cool of a model mice are in the world of science. I hope you find it interesting and got some new pieces of trivia to throw around at parties. You may never know when they come in hand. They also work as pickup lines. Example: hey girl, are you a lab mouse? Because I want to test my charm on you. Yes, I came up with it myself. I swear it worked. Let me know if it worked for you too. You never know. See you in the next one.